Hello, everybody. I'm Dr. Shabnam Daskar, a functional medicine doctor. And this is the very first episode of the Brain Podcast. And I'm honored to have my wonderful associate, Dr. Natasha Iyer, with me. And we are going to talk about women, hormones, and the brain. So Natasha, will you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Dr. Carr. I'm Dr. Natasha Iyer. I practice functional medicine in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I have a special interest and focus on women and hormones, and in particular, how to prescribe hormones safely, understanding that it's not about just getting a prescription, that there are many steps to take to prepare the body for optimal and safe hormone therapy.
Thank you, Natasha. So what both of us are going to talk about today is, number one, what is different in relation to women, hormones, and Alzheimer's disease? And more importantly, since our focus today is on hormones, now we are not going to talk about all the hormones that matter for the brain, because thyroid is extremely important, cortisol is extremely important, insulin is extremely important, but we are going to restrict ourselves today to estrogen, progesterone. And the other important thing is the question that I'm sure everyone wants an answer to is, will hormone therapy kill you or will it help your brain and heart function better? So,
right.
Yeah, Natasha, I mean, I'm sure you get this so often, right? That a patient comes to you for hormone therapy and then, you know, they go back to their cardiologist and they're told that, oh, you're going to die, right?
Oh, my goodness. I had that happen. And I actually asked you for your input as director of medical education for our clinics. And this lady was given transdermal hormone therapy and her cardiologist said, nope, you cannot be on hormones. And I said, please give me the most recent studies to send for reference. And then this is a well-known story. I had a patient for years. I was telling her that she's insulin resistant and at risk for heart disease. Being a vegetarian, her triglycerides were really high. And I'm sure, you know, you'll teach about all these things. But when she came to me, she didn't need estrogen. So I had given her DHEA and testosterone as her hormone therapies. Now, no matter how old you are and how not updated you are, nobody talks about testosterone being a negative component to do with heart disease, right? And so when she went to the anyway, she had a cardiac event, was airlifted out to a major hospital. And this was because, you know, lifestyle and insulin resistance didn't make sense to her to change because she thought she was very healthy as a vegetarian and at the right weight. So, you know, we ended up with a cardiovascular event. And you know, I'm talking about the heart, but the same thing can happen in the brain, Dr. Carr. That's why your little logo has a heart and a brain, because they're so connected. And what happens in one happens in the other. But this particular patient, you know, the doctor said to her, what are you taking? And she said, I'm taking hormones. He didn't ask what hormones she's on. He just told her she had to stop them. They're bad for her. And that was that. Like, there was no further discussion. And I had to laugh because a cardiologist, one, didn't understand that triglycerides were actually a risk factor for heart disease and pointing to her insulin resistance. And secondly, he didn't ask which hormones. She wasn't on estrogen. Now, I know today you want to talk about estrogen, so we'll stop with my story and let you continue.
So, Natasha, I want to talk about estrogen and progesterone. So we are coming to that. And
oh, sorry. Dr. Yes, I had her. I did have her on progesterone, okay. Testosterone, and DHEA.
Thank you. So, and you'll understand why Dr. Iyer and I are so passionate about progesterone and estrogen is the big diva. So we'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about why hormone therapy got a bad rep some years ago. Right. So going back to cognition and Alzheimer's disease particularly. So Natasha, I don't meet anyone who doesn't want better brain function. And I'm sure you are likewise as well. Do you find any patient you ask, do you want your brain to function better? She'll say no. She's very happy with where she's at.
Yeah.
So, and it applies to me and Dr. Iyer as well. We would love to have better brain function or maintain our existing brain function until old age. So going back to women and Alzheimer's disease, now we know that Alzheimer's disease starts at 20 to 30 years before someone actually develops symptoms. Now, this is information that is not commonly known, I think, Natasha, other than those of us who are bothered about the brain. That is number one. And number two, there are more women with Alzheimer's disease than men. So until a few years ago, the thinking was, oh, women live longer. So because age is one of the biggest risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. And here we're only talking about Alzheimer's disease, but there are many other dementias as well. Alzheimer's is the commonest one. So because women live longer, so it's like, oh, that's why they get more Alzheimer's. But in the last few years, there have been some really interesting research. And I'm going to post the research paper in the show notes. One paper which was really fascinating was Dr. Lisa Mosconi. She's written a book actually called The XX Brain. So what she did is because Alzheimer's starts 20 to 30 years before someone develops symptoms, that period corresponds to the perimenopausal period. So Natasha, will you, for the sake of our audience, will you explain what is perimenopause and what is menopause?
Okay, menopause is diagnosed officially when you are without your menstrual cycle for one full year. The perimenopause is that period of hormonal changes leading up to the menopause. And I have to say, women are really, really challenged with perimenopause and all the symptoms that come with it. And yet almost no one knows that they can do something about it. Now in the perimenopause, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, all of these hormone levels are changing. And sometimes they're high, sometimes they're low, and not all together at the same levels. So it's a period of fluctuating hormones, and it can be very difficult to manage. Even for me, I've been prescribing hormones for 16 years now. And I have to tell you, you know, there are some women where you'll prescribe and then it just whacks you because their body did something different from what you were expecting. So the perimenopause is a very interesting state for women because they're struggling with insomnia, and insomnia really affects brain function. They're struggling with anxiety, and that's hormone related, but then it's brain affected, right? And so brain chemistry is changing as well based on this. Is that more or less what you are wanting to focus on, Dr. Carr, in the perimenopause or something else?
Thank you. Thank you, Natasha. So basically, the diagnosis of menopause, as Dr. Iyer mentioned, it is retrospective. So you may not have been getting your cycles for 3 months, but technically we can't say you are in menopause because you've not completed 12 months. But, and Dr. Iyer in her practice checks hormone levels in every patient. So Natasha, what you rightly pointed out is, now this is again knowledge which is, you know, a lot of people are not aware. And I was a former OBGY. I didn't know a lot of this. So most people think of, oh, perimenopause and menopause is a time when you lose estrogen. The fact is, it's not only estrogen, it is progesterone as well. And sometimes some women have very high levels of estrogen and not enough progesterone during the perimenopausal period. And that can impact brain function dramatically, because the most important thing for us to remember is, now the differences in Alzheimer's disease risk between men and women, we will talk about that on another episode, but today we are restricting ourselves to the sex hormones. So one is these sex hormones, so estrogen, progesterone, and estrogen, there are three different types. These are also called neurosteroids. So what does neurosteroid mean? Steroid is the chemical structure. Neuro meaning our brains, nervous system. So what it means when we use the term neurosteroids is the brain has the ability to make these hormones locally. So even after, you know, menopause, if the ovary is not producing any of these hormones, is the adrenal glands which are producing, the brain has that ability. And I was recently telling someone, Natasha, Mother Nature does not build redundancy. So if the brain has the ability to make these hormones locally, obviously there are actions for these hormones, right? Now going back to the perimenopausal transition and Dr. Lisa Mosconi's paper. So what she did, she got a group of younger women between 40 to 60 years of age, and she divided them into different groups. So she put them through a PET scanning. So that's a brain scanning. Now, brain scanning is extremely important because going by just symptoms or, you know, the mini mental status examination, you just do a bunch of questionnaires, that is not enough to detect, you know, early problems. So what she did is she found, and again, I apologize for the, you know, very sciencey sounding terms, but we'll try to explain. What she found is that during the perimenopausal period, the brain sort of loses its ability to use glucose as a fuel for brain function. Now, that does not mean that the brain stops functioning because, as I said, you know, Mother Nature is very, very sophisticated. So what she found is that instead of using glucose as a fuel for the brain, our brains have the ability to use lipids, so fats. So instead of using glucose, ketones are being used. And here is where, Natasha, a lot of people get confused. And before I talk about brain glucose and how, you know, whether the food you eat should provide glucose or not for the brain, I'm just going to mention another thing is, recent years, we've been talking a lot about Alzheimer's disease being type 3 diabetes. Now, we know that people who have type 2 diabetes are at a higher risk for cognitive decline. But Alzheimer's is also considered as, you know, diabetes of the brain. Mm. So, Natasha, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how people get confused about, oh, the brain needs glucose, so I must eat a bunch of carbohydrates, otherwise the brain is not going to get fueled.
That's just, and you're probably going to add more to this conversation than me, but what I explain to patients is in the old days, we used to even think in the old days, well, I graduated 26 years ago. So similar to you.
50 years ago.
Yeah. So, you know, back then we thought that the brain was stagnant or the whole nervous system was, you know, if it got damaged, it couldn't repair itself. What you got is what you got. So, you know, you have a stroke, that's it. You have some brain injury, that's it. Some spinal cord injury, that's it. There's no recovery. Whereas now we know that the brain is ever changing. I mean, there's neuroplasticity. You can create new brain pathways. So in that time, we used to always think that the primary source for fuel for the brain is glucose. And we obsessed with that. And we would tell people you need to have sugar in your body for your brain to work. Well, how opposite it is now when we know that Alzheimer's is classically called diabetes type 3 because it's diabetes in the brain. It's an issue with how we transport sugar in the brain and how we take that sugar and cause, how do you describe that? So sugar combines with proteins and they cause enlargement of certain molecules that should pass freely, but now they're too big and they can't pass freely. So they start plugging up things in the brain, like tiny, tiny blood vessels, for example. And so when you have sugar in the brain and insulin being released to deal with the sugar in the brain, it's causing the brain to be affected. And this is the foundational mechanism for Alzheimer's. Is that clear, Dr. Kaur? Is that correct?
Thank you, Natasha. The one point that I want to highlight, because Dr. Iyer and I talk a lot about food for the brain and food for the heart. So as she mentioned, heart and brain function are not very different when it comes to risks. So the point is, we do not need to eat carbohydrates for our body to make carbohydrates. Our bodies have the ability to make carbohydrates. But when it comes to fat, particularly like omega-3 fatty acids, those are called essential fatty acids. So that means our body does not have the ability to make them. So we need to get them either from food or a combination of food and supplements. More about omega-3 and the brain on another episode. It's a lot to talk about. But there are also some amino acids. Amino acids make protein. So there are also some amino acids which are called essential amino acids because our body does not have the ability to make them. So carbohydrate is not an essential nutrient. That means our bodies have the ability to make them. So you don't need to eat sugar or food that becomes sugar. Natasha, I like it how you described that, you know, food that makes sugar. So, but you do need to prioritize protein and good fat. Anyway, going back to Dr. Lisa Mosconi's study. So what she found is that these women in the perimenopausal period, they were going through something called brain glucose hypometabolism. So brain and glucose, you understand, hypo is less. So metabolism, essentially the brain was having a fueling problem 20 to 30 years before someone was actually developing any symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And why is that? Because all these sex hormones are extremely important for our metabolism. There are actually estrogen receptors in the pancreas as well. So pancreas makes insulin. However, what Dr. Iyer and I have are, you know, I'm using air quotes, issues with many of these studies are, they will look at estrogen. Now, there are three different types of estrogen, E1, E2, E3. E2 is the estrogen of, which has 400 different functions in the body. E3 is the estrogen of pregnancy, and E1 is essentially the estrogen of the menopausal period, where it is also called a potential carcinogen. So higher levels of E1 are related to higher risk for breast cancer. So just an aside, E1 is not a hormone that is ever prescribed as a supplement, as a part of hormone therapy. E2 and E3 are the ones that are usually prescribed. And I'll let Dr. Iyer talk a little bit about what, how hormone therapy is different in functional medicine world versus in the traditional medicine world. We'll come to that later. So what they found is brain glucose hypometabolism. So obviously the problem started earlier. Now, the most important question, Natasha, everyone will want to know is, will hormone therapy make them feel better? And will it help them save their brains and hearts? So that is where, you know, what recent studies have shown is that there is a window of opportunity. So that is called the timing hypothesis when it comes to brain, heart, and metabolism function. So adding hormone therapy earlier in the menopause versus adding later on in the menopause has a different effect. Now, this does not mean that if you are older and you have sort of missed that 5 to 6 years window, that you should not be on hormone therapy. And Natasha, will you add a little bit there? Because I know you have a lot of older women who are on hormones and they will not stop their hormones, right?
Well, I'll classically tell you about two women in their 70s who came to me, right? And so the one lady had severe fibromyalgia, depression, a whole lot of medical symptoms, and by the time we were done replacing her hormones, her and she calls him her sweetie, so they're very much in love after 50 years of being married, but her and her sweetie could go on walks, she could paint the kitchen and the 6-foot fence around the house, they were having sex 3 times a week and enjoying it, and she found her life very satisfying. Even though, you know, if you stick with the timing hypothesis, then she should not have been an ideal candidate. She had so much improvement in her mood and mental functioning that she was a retired psychologist. She's quite a remarkable lady. She actually was a pharmacist and at age 50 became a psychologist. So she likes a good brain and needs an amazing brain. But, you know, as she got to her 70, she had to quit her practice and she wasn't coping with anything. And here we are, you know, hormone therapy later, and she's ready to open up her practice again and deal with women going through aging to guide them through. And that was her focus, to have a practice that focused on guiding women through the older years comfortably. And she wouldn't have done any of that had we not done the process. And the other lady is a lady in her 70s. And one of her primary complaints, and this has nothing to do with the brain, but waking up 3 to 4 times a night to pee. And yes, her assistant would come with her and say, you know, her, I'm worried she's getting dementia. She's forgetful. She's, you know, and she won't admit any of these things. Well, she didn't quite notice it as much as her assistant noticed it. She's very active, you know, golfs, bikes, hikes, all of that, but was noticing that her skin was aging, just complaining about general loss of well-being and functioning. And then the assistant was, you have to look after her brain. That's why I brought her here. Like, you've got to fix her brain. And, you know, now her brain works just fine. She is not as dependent on having an assistant to drop her, fetch her, drive her around, and all of those things. She is doing so much better. Never mind that she found a boyfriend 20 years younger than herself and is having a great old time. In fact, she said, thank God I have brick walls or my neighbors would hear it.
And another thing, Natasha, thank you for sharing that. Another important thing is your patients are not just using hormones. They have completely overhauled their lifestyle as well. So more about that later. Going back to yours and my pet peeve is whenever you find people talking about perimenopausal period, menopause, it's always estrogen, estrogen, estrogen. Most people don't even think of progesterone, and progesterone is the sort of the poor cousin which doesn't get the importance it should, because progesterone is a very important hormone when it comes to calming the brain. So that is the reason Dr. Iyer and I have a lot of, and Natasha, so many times I have emailed the authors of these papers. So what happens is for Dr. Iyer and me, we have to focus on what we call translational medicine. That means researcher comes up with some research findings. What Dr. Iyer and I are concerned is, number one, how does it apply to my patients and how does it apply to me or to us? Actually, I think I would say, Natasha, first of all, we think of ourselves, right? So going back to our pet peeves about, you know, many of these studies, they only look at estrogen, they look at FSH, LH, those are important, no doubt. But very rarely will you find papers where they look at all the hormones, DHEA, testosterone, progesterone, all the different estrogens, FSH, LH. And I understand it's expensive to do those kind of studies. So that is very important. But before all of that, Natasha, I just want you to add a few words about how did hormone therapy get that bad reputation way back when the WHI study came out, and why do a lot of doctors scare their patient that you're going to die if you're on hormone therapy?
Well, first of all, if any doctor tells you that, Shabnam, which year did the WHI come out in?
It was 2003.
Well, 10 years after the fact, they went back and looked at the data and produced another report on it. So if anybody is talking about the initial WHI, they're really outdated and not keeping up with the science.
Yeah.
So that's my first comment. Because they went back and reviewing the data, they came up with some very interesting information showing that other than the synthetic progestin, hormones were actually useful for women. But what happened on the initial study is that they used a combination of estrogen and medroxyprogesterone acetate. Sorry, I didn't say that well. But so medroxyprogesterone acetate is a synthetic hormone. The Premarin that they used is an oral estrogen derived from pregnant horses. So still a bit more natural in its source, but the progesterone was completely synthesized. And what they found was that there was an increased risk for heart attacks and cancer in women taking these hormones. And they stopped the study years before they planned to, as they started to notice this increase.
Thank you, Natasha. And so what happened is those were oral estrogens, and they also contained the E1. So a lot of that was, so Dr. Iyer and I call them the horsey estrogen. So it also contained estrone sulfate, the E1, which is associated with cancer and all those things. And the progesterone was not a progesterone at all. Dr. Iyer talked about medroxyprogesterone acetate, so MPA. So in terms of the chemical structure of MPA and the oral estrogens, it was very different from what is hormone therapy today. So number one, we do not recommend oral estrogens because it increases inflammation, it raises your risk for heart disease, stroke, all the bad stuff. And number two, so very often, Natasha, this is even in research papers, I have had to email authors and ask, are you using MPA? Are you talking about the progesterone that the body makes? So the bioidentical progesterone, and that is available either as a compounded hormone or even as a prescription pharmaceutical product. And 17 beta estradiol is the estrogen that our bodies make. So that is also available to use as a hormone therapy. So the hormone therapy today is very different from what hormone therapy was then when the WHI study came out. And in fact, the other important factor was many of those women on that study were older women. They were not younger women nearer to menopause. But recent studies, when they looked at younger women, the timing hypothesis was very important. And another important factor, Natasha, recently, you know, someone wrote a paper which I thought was so, you know, profound. The last, you know, paragraph in that was, unfortunately, one, you know, large group of young doctors have not been introduced to this knowledge of what is hormone therapy. And I was talking to somebody and she has a young daughter who's a medical student, and she told her mother, oh, no, you should never be on hormone therapy. And I said, your daughter doesn't know. She may be a medical student, but she doesn't know what hormone therapy is today. So estrogen applied to the skin as a cream or a patch works very differently compared to estrogen taken as a pill, number one. Number two, the progesterone that we use now is called oral micronized progesterone or the compounded one, which is structurally similar to what our bodies make, versus the MPA, which is very different in structure. So it does not work the same way. Now, going back to the brain, so what did they find in their study? So what they found is women who were on hormone therapy, they had less of brain glucose hypometabolism. So you don't want your brain to use less of glucose. You want your brain to have adequate fuel, right? So hormone therapy had helped. And some other papers, and I will post the links to all the papers. Another paper, this was from way back in 2013, from Dr. Barbara Sherwin. So what she did is she looked at women who were on estrogen, this was oral estrogen plus the MPA, and women who were on estrogen and the oral micronized progesterone, that is the bioidentical one. The ones who were on the bioidentical one, not the progestin, not the MPA, which has all the problems, they did better in terms of their functioning of the prefrontal cortex. So the prefrontal cortex is your CEO of your brain. And with age, the prefrontal cortex function diminishes. So estrogen, even the oral one, plus the oral micronized progesterone, not the progestin, they worked better in terms of improving prefrontal cortex function. And then, of course, in some lab studies, they found, this was very interesting, Natasha, I found that out recently. They found in lab studies that the MPA actually countered the effects of estrogen. But this was not in a clinical study. This was in the lab. And of course, we are not surprised that MPA has been causing problems all the time.
And that's what they found out in the WHI review when they went back, right? And they found out that the estrogen only arm, women still had benefit even from the horse estrogen. And even though it was given by mouth, which we never do today, you know, talking about that, you know, that's the difference today when we're talking about hormone therapy. I do not write oral estrogen. I do not write estrogen as a pill that you can swallow. The only estrogen I write is transdermal, meaning a cream, which is compounded and made in a dose specifically for each person based on their ratios to other hormones and their ratio to each other. For example, the E1, the E2, and the E3. That being said, we know that it's safer to use estrogen on the skin because it's less inflammatory and it doesn't affect blood clotting. So it is very safe. And this is what I had to discuss with those patients I mentioned earlier, where the heart specialists are, you shouldn't take hormones. Well, because they heard about the WHI, because it made every single newspaper in the world and every TV and radio station, it caused such a stir. You couldn't go anywhere without hearing that hormone therapy was bad. And everyone should get off of it. But, you know, when the review came out years later, no one covered it to that degree. And so, yeah, that's another reason why some people are outdated in their information. But, you know, it's a great point to make in that estrogen is important for brain function. You have receptors for estrogen in your brain. Your brain actually comes back. And I, what I mean by this is, you know, for me personally, when my estrogen levels started dropping, and I used to say this to you frequently, I'm losing my brain. Like I would read and I couldn't retain as well. I just, I mean, it didn't affect me on a day-to-day basis, but everything took longer. You know, I'd have to read it again. I'd have to process it again. I would forget where I put my keys. I would, you know, forget people's names. I'd be looking at this actor on TV with my kids and going, who the heck is that? I know who he is, you know? So a lot of different changes go on in the brain, but there, you know, when you're getting forgetful, the first thing you think is, am I getting Alzheimer's disease? And, you know, 6 weeks on estrogen and what a difference in the function of my brain. And you say that too. You say, I can't be without my estrogen on a day I have a presentation or you know, something to do with my brain.
Yeah. So the one thing I want to highlight is the difference in hormone therapy in, you know, the guideline recommendation versus what we do in functional medicine. So in guideline recommended hormone therapy, a woman who's had a hysterectomy, that means a removal of the uterus at surgery, she is not given progesterone because the thinking is, oh, she doesn't have a uterus, so she doesn't need to prevent uterine cancer, so she can take only estrogen. And Natasha, so many times I've spoken at conferences and I said, do you mean when a woman, you know, has her uterus removed, she also has her brain gone at that time?
I say it the opposite way. I say, you mean if you don't have a uterus, you don't care about your brain? But yeah.
Yeah. So progesterone is extremely important for the brain because it makes something called allopregnanolone, which is one of the metabolites of progesterone. So it's extremely important for the brain. So not just preventing cancer, you know, uterine cancer, you don't have a uterus, you don't need progesterone. That is one big difference. The other big difference between functional medicine approach to hormone therapy is hormones are a symphony. So Natasha, you and I know our fellowship professor, she always says, you cannot just give too much of estrogen and a little bit of progesterone and think everything is going to be fine, unless you also balance DHEA, testosterone, and everything else, inflammation, insulin resistance. So hormone therapy is not just about slathering a bunch of, you know, cream on your skin and taking an oral progesterone tablet and you are good. No, it is much more than that, number one. Number two, Natasha, because we are running out of time, I'm just going to highlight another thing. So guidelines, if you are going to look at guidelines, they will say that hormone therapy is not recommended as a prevention of dementia or prevention of cardiovascular disease. That means heart disease and stroke. But hormone therapy is recommended in women who have symptoms. So Natasha, will you tell our audience about what are some of the symptoms? And I don't meet any women who are middle-aged who don't have those symptoms. So can you tell us about a few of those symptoms? And I'll post a link to a questionnaire which has the symptoms.
You know, should we start at the top to the bottom or the bottom to the top?
Maybe just some of the ones that people don't think are a part of, you know, of reducing or diminishing or imbalance of hormone levels. I would think weepiness is one of the big ones.
Sorry, weepiness.
Yeah, you feel like crying at, you know, even every simple, anything you can, you watch on TV.
That's right. That is exactly right. I mean, that is the most common thing that we deal with, right? Like they're emotional, they're irritable, they're retaining fluid, they're weight gain. Say again?
Anxiety.
the anxiety, but mood, for sure, it's mood symptoms. You know, they're just not feeling as good mood-wise as they might. Now, they won't always say, I'm depressed, but depression is a frequent one, fatigue. But I'll tell you, the more common ones are, I'm forgetful, mm-hmm. I have brain fog, my brain just doesn't work as well as it used to. And then there's, you know, as you move down, as I was teasing before, it's they'll wake up at night to go to the bathroom to pee. They have vaginal dryness. Intercourse is painful. These are very important to quality of life. If you're not sleeping, your brain is getting affected because we know your brain rests and repairs while you're sleeping. Well, it doesn't actually rest, it's working, but it does different things while you're sleeping. So if your sleep is interrupted by getting up to go pee, that's making all your symptoms worse because now you're suffering from lack of sleep. And insomnia is a big one. I mean, insomnia is a big one.
Absolutely. And Natasha, very interestingly, you haven't mentioned that the commonest symptom is hot flashes. And that is so interesting because whenever people talk about menopausal symptoms, the first thing they think of is hot flashes. Now, not everyone may have hot flashes.
I did that on purpose.
I know.
Because everyone assumes that the first sign of menopause is hot flashes. And so if you ask anyone what's a symptom of the menopause, they'll tell you hot flashes. But I will tell you this. Estrogen dominant women, so who have in the perimenopause quite high estrogens, can also have hot flashes. So it's not related to low estrogen. I have a lot of women with adrenal dysregulation, so HPA axis dysregulation, the old term was adrenal fatigue. And a lot of women will have normal estrogen and have hot flashes because their cortisol levels are off. And this is why when I introduced myself, I talked about, you know, I love helping women balance their hormones, but there's a specific process to follow. And there's a lot of hormone interactions, as you mentioned, a symphony. And we can't assume that. And I mean, like even brain fog, for example, you know, it could be dysbiosis, it could be insomnia, it could be so many other things other than low estrogen. But as a constellation of symptoms, yes, in the perimenopause and menopause, as we're changing estrogens, we see a lot of brain symptoms.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing is many women, and depending on their ethnicity, do not experience hot flashes as much as they do the other psychological symptoms like anxiety, insomnia, and in general, pains and aches of the body. That is much commoner in some people. So menopause does not mean just hot flashes. And the second important thing is hormone therapy is recommended as a treatment for menopausal symptoms. And Dr. Iyer and I don't meet any women who don't have any of these symptoms that we just listed. So that is what I wanted to highlight. And the other thing is you mentioned the perimenopause. So perimenopause hormone levels can be really wildly fluctuating. And as Dr. Iyer mentioned, it's difficult to sometimes balance well. So my point is, if you are in that phase of your life, you need to meet a doctor who understands hormone therapy well. And you need to be a little patient because sometimes it may take a little while to get to your sweet spot. And your sweet spot may be very different from someone else's. So in conclusion, what I would like to say is, number one, if you are Dr. Iyer's patient or my patient, that's different. But if you are, you know, you're looking at hormone therapy and you're going through all these symptoms of the brain and you want to prevent dementia. Another big one, Natasha, we didn't have time to talk about is blood glucose regulation. Now, again, blood glucose regulation, hormone therapy is not the only solution. Food comes first and rest of lifestyle. But blood glucose levels are, you know, they change during the menopausal transition as well. So if you are, you know, looking at hormone therapy and wondering whether you should, you know, you need to go for hormone therapy or you should not, one is you can do the menopause questionnaire and take those, you know, the questionnaire responses to your doctor, and hopefully your doctor will support you. But not oral estrogens, transdermal estrogens, that is estrogen as a cream or a patch, and oral micronized progesterone, not MPA. those are the big ones. And again, both of us are not providing medical recommendations on the podcast, but that is very important to know the difference between the different types of hormone therapy. And more importantly, whether hormone therapy is right for you or not. If you have had a diagnosis of breast cancer, definitely hormone therapy is not for you. But there are a lot of other things that you can do for the brain as well.
You know, there's nuances to that, because mm-hmm. when you're 5 to 10 years post breast cancer, based on certain other parameters that we would check from a functional medicine perspective, I'm not opposed to treating a woman with estrogen. It just depends on many, many factors, right? But she'd have to be cancer-free for a prolonged period of time. And I'll tell you a story just as we wrap up. When the WHI came out, I was working in a small town up in northern Alberta, and the female partner of the practice that I worked for was on hormone replacement therapy. She'd had a hysterectomy in her 40s, she was early 50s, and she was taking Premarin. And when the WHI came out, I was like, oh my gosh, now we've got to start taking everyone off of estrogen. And she said, you know what? I will never stop my hormones. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I will end up killing someone and end up in jail. So I am not going to not take my hormones. They save me. And so I end up with breast cancer. I don't care. I'm checking every year. And back then we didn't even know what functional medicine was, right? So, but she felt that her brain function and her mood and irritability management were important enough to her to take a risk and monitor herself. Today in functional medicine, we have such sophisticated methods to look at a person's risk. And the fact that we're hypervigilant, I just think it's an individual decision.
Absolutely.
So yeah. I'm not saying if you had breast cancer, you have a family history, run out and get hormones. I'm saying each person decides what's most important to them. I mean, some people go get their breasts and ovaries removed if they have a family history and risk, whereas others will say, I will change my lifestyle. I understand that I have 80% control over how my genes express themselves. I don't need to end up with breast cancer. I can do the work that it takes and still feel better than ever. And you said no woman will say that they don't want to have a good brain. I don't know any woman who will say, I want to watch myself age rapidly. And estrogen is important for your brain, your bone, your heart, and your skin. It helps you stop aging of the skin. I just threw that in because it's another benefit of hormone therapy.
Yeah, and Dr. R is an aesthetic physician as well. So she sees it in real life in her practice every day. And progesterone is extremely important for sleep and reducing anxiety. So it's all about hormonal balance. And I think I will end this episode here. I think we've spoken for quite a while. And all the information and the references will be in the show notes. And goodbye.
Take care. Thank you, Shabnam. Take care.